1995 Sandstone Symposium presents session number 324, A Sermon, A Curriculum for Moral Storytellers, by Bruce Jorgensen.
Inclusive and ever-expanding perception of what Mormon literature should be. There's a kind of creative freedom that comes with allowing diversity, and that's the movement that Bruce has defended. Bruce Jorgensen was born in Salina, and according Salina, Utah, and according to him, he was incompletely educated in public schools there, then at Brigham Young University, and later on a Woodrow Wilson and Danforth fellowships at Cornell, where he received his MA in 69 and his PhD in 78 in English and American literature. He has taught at Southern Utah State College, part-time at Ithaca College, part-time and short-term at Syracuse and Cornell, and since 1975, full-time at Brigham Young University. He is married, the father of three daughters and five sons, and the grandfather of two girls and twin boys. He has studied fiction writing with Eileen Cumpett, BYU, James McConkie at Cornell, George P. Eliot at Syracuse, and John Hawks at Duke University Writers' Workshop. His poems, stories, reviews, and essays have appeared in The Ensign, Sunstone, Dialogue, Carolina Quarterly, Modern Fiction Studies, Literature and Belief, BYU Studies, Wasatch Review, and High Plains Literary Review. His most recent published story, Who Jane, Who Tarzan, in the April 1994 issue of High Plains, received awards from the Utah Arts Council and the Association for Mormon Letters, and was nominated for the Pushcart Prize. The telling and hearing of stories has been the main study of his life since childhood. He has begun to perceive that everything he has written thus far is a long, intermittent exploration of the LDS scriptural declaration that, quote, the spirit and the body are the soul of man, end quote. As a Mormon literary critic, he hopes to do the work of Abraham, who, among other things, waited in the door of his tent to welcome strangers and pleaded with Yahweh to spare Sodom for the sake of even 10 righteous persons. He says that he will be happy to entertain discussion questions at the end of his presentation if you're thus inclined. And so when he's done here, we'll hear from Bruce Jorgensen.
Thank you, Rob. I'm honored more than I deserve, I think, by Rob Van Wagener actually changing his plans just to be here to introduce me, and I'm honored that a few of you would come when, after all, at this hour, one of your alternatives is to be listening to Tom and Ray Malyotzi, the Clackett, Click and Clack, the Tappan brothers, on NPR's Car Talk, which is one of my favorite Saturday morning activities. I was just conferring with someone there about whether or not to bring in an overhead projector. I had requested one so that I could put the full text of Luke 15 up on a wall or screen. But I think since the symposium program includes the full text, if you want to refer to a text, it is there. The text, then. Then drew near unto him all the publicans and sinners for to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes murmured, saying, This man receiveth sinners, and eateth with them. I will let the first two verses of chapter 15 stand for the entire text, though in a sense they might be the entire text for what I want to say. In any case, here at the outset, those verses remind us where we stand. Somewhere near enough to hear him. The question is, who are we? Who am I and who are you? Publican? Sinner? Pharisee? Scribe? As always, I style myself a scribe and not one having authority. As a scribe, a devotee of texts, I want to hear what the text, which does have authority, says. I've been paying attention to the three tales in this text, to how they're told, and trying to tell my students about them since the fall of 1986, when in an honors freshman colloquium one day, I stumbled quite unplanned into a retelling of Luke 15 and started to hear what was going on. I've gone on doing that, retelling and talking about the telling, usually without plan, but of course with an increasing number of decreasingly spontaneous performances behind me, whenever in a literature or writing class it has seemed pertinent or helpful to try to say what two moral storytellers, Luke and Jesus, do in this chapter. Maybe there are more than two. Maybe we should include the lost son and the father in the third parable, and also the shepherd and the housewife in the first two. And why not the servant and the elder son in the third? Tell me, and here I slip into something akin to the voice of Melville's Ishmael in Moby Dick, otherwise this allusion might not work. He says, tell me who ain't a slave in this world. And I'm saying, tell me who ain't a storyteller in this world, from Adam and Eve on down to you and me. And a careful reader of Luke 15 would notice that, in fact, every character in that chapter, in all three parables, does, in a sense, tell a story. That's part of what goes on when we talk. And that's one of the important things to keep in mind. I guess I should acknowledge, too, that 10 years is about my usual gestation rate. I get an idea, and maybe 10 years down the line, it'll get written. This man receiveth sinners and eateth with them. Whom do you welcome, and with whom do you share food? That implicit Pharisaic question is the occasion of these three tales, the ones we call the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the prodigal son. And one might dare to say parenthetically that this is a question that floats over every Sunstone symposium. The occasion and context is a question about hospitality. Yet that won't be my primary focus. Rather than attending to the themes or the messages of these three tales, I will attend to how they are told. But that can't be detached from to whom and to what. To the Pharisees, and to their complaint with its implied question, which the tales answer. Why? Why does this supposed holy man, this teacher and healer, welcome sinners and eat with them? I might mention that Luke's preceding chapter, which begins with Jesus dining at the house of one of the chief Pharisees, has been centrally concerned with hospitality, with what to do when thou art bidden, chapter 14, verse 8 or verse 10, or when thou makest a dinner or a supper, chapter 14, verse 12, with where to sit and whom to invite. But there's no time for that context here and now. That might be the next project 10 years farther on. The main thing, the largest thing to notice about Jesus' three tales in this chapter is how different in structure the first two are from the third. I'm assuming for this discussion that whether or not all three were told on a single historical occasion, Luke has framed them as he does because he wants us to see their relationships, their continuity and discontinuity, their similarity and difference. About Luke framing them, I should just mention that this chapter is rather clearly demarcated from the one preceding it, and that the following chapter is said also unto his disciples, so that's rather clearly demarcated from this one, even if the I don't know, I'm assuming Luke's chapter numbers are not Luke's, but it seems to me that there is a clearly demarcated unit of discourse here. Okay, the first two parables begin as questions. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he lose one of them, doth not go after that which is lost until he find it? Either what woman, having 10 pieces of silver, if she lose one piece, doth not seek diligently till she find it? The address of such questions to their hearers, Jesus' Pharisaic challengers, is quite direct, aggressively so, with the emphatic second person, "What man of you?" And both of these first two tales conclude with the teller explaining the tale of the lost sheep. "I say unto you, that likewise joy shall be in heaven over one sinner that repenteth more than over 99 just persons which need no repentance." There's no mistaking the point here, and no mistaking to whom it applies. Those Pharisees who have just presented themselves as just persons which need no repentance, as distinguished from the sinners whom Jesus receiveth and eateth with. The explanatory close of the second tale pulls back from that and declares simply, without any comparative more than, "Likewise I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repenteth." Structurally, tactically, these tales stop just short of the hortatory. Despite their aggressive second-person address, "What man of you?" and twice, "I say unto you," they are not in the imperative, not in the mode of command or of exhortation, just barely. And either tale by itself might suffice to answer the Pharisees' implied question: "Why do you receive sinners and eat with them?" "I'm glad to receive and eat with sinners who turn to me. Isn't God? Aren't the angels? Wouldn't you be?" The third tale, on both these counts, is radically different. No second person address by the teller to the hearers, and no interpretive conclusion to nail down the message. To begin, just Luke's, "And he said, a certain man had two sons." And to end, only silence, both Jesus and Luke. But before taking up that third tale, look at some other features of structure and sequence in the first two. Most noticeably, each focuses on a single protagonist, a man, a shepherd, and a woman, a housewife, and on a similar series of acts by each: losing, seeking, finding, calling friends and neighbors to rejoice. Within the teller's frame of second-person address, each tale is told in a third-person objective point of view, simply the deeds and one speech by each protagonist, which rather directly imply two obvious motives: desire to find what was lost, and desire to share joy when it is found. "Rejoice with me, for I have found." Jesus' reply to the Pharisees' disparagement of his habits as host and guest should be equally glaringly obvious. "Why do I receive and eat with sinners? Why don't you join us?" The differences between the first two tales seem less important than their differences from the third. A sheep may get lost by its own straying. Sheep are stupid, and sometimes stupidly obstinate. I learned that one hot, dust-choked summer afternoon in my teens, trying with a couple of my cousins to herd a bunch for my Uncle John from the auction pens to his feed yard across the river, stalled for hours at the bridge till Uncle John, over 6 feet tall and maybe 300 pounds, but even then carrying an oxygen bottle and a respirator in his truck, just waded into that bunch and started toting them across bodily. Finally, we got them moving. Well, that's my one sheep herding story. That's my sheep herder career right there. A coin, in contrast, has to get lost by its owner's carelessness or neglect. Whether that difference should matter when the tale's protagonists both stand for the God who rejoices when sinners repent, I'll have to leave for more authoritative minds to declare. The point this scribe sees is to rejoice generously when the lost is found. With that point so clearly made in the voice of the teller, perhaps the third tale can stand as it does, bare of direct second-person address and authoritative interpretation. Yet an already established thematic context won't account for all of the last tale's complex difference. Why bother if you've already made your point so unambiguously clearly? We may get closer to that difference, that complicated difference, if we move through the first two tales not as a thematic prelude or frame, but as in themselves a dynamic narrative sequence, which may actually have happened, but in any case is here constructed by Luke. An interplay between teller and silent hearers, which brings the teller to the point where the tale of the man with two sons is his last best shot, all the more potent for not being aimed so straight at his audience. It's not clear just where Jesus is when he tells these tales. A couple of chapters earlier, he went through the cities and villages teaching and journeying toward Jerusalem. At one point, uttering his famous lament, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, which killest the prophets," again underscoring the theme of reception or rejection, of hearing or not hearing a teller. And when he utters that lament, it's as though he were somewhere near Jerusalem. I mean, in order to say, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem," you would think he might be nearby, but perhaps not. Two chapters after Luke 15, he's still passing through the midst of Samaria and Galilee on his way there. A chapter earlier, he has eaten bread on the Sabbath day in the house of one of the chief Pharisees, as I've already mentioned. Well, all this fuss is by way of suggesting that the setting of Luke 15 might be urban, though probably not the capital. Supposing that, and reading, and perhaps overreading, Luke's silences about the Pharisees' reaction to any of the tales as strategic rather than mere default. That is, I'm assuming Luke does what he does because he means to do it, not just because he forgets or, you know, doesn't know or whatever, that this is deliberate. Anyway, reading those and perhaps overreading those silences, I see something like this. The first tale is too upcountry for an audience of urban Pharisees. It's a hick story, a sheepherder story. In a word, pastoral. So, met with silence as with a blank look, the teller next tries an indoor, domestic setting, a house in a city or village, for a tale focused on a more urban form of wealth, cash. Again, I suppose a space of silence after the teller's interpretive conclusion, and then overread that silence as yet another glum stare from the Pharisees, even though this time he has held back that mild, indirect affront of just persons which need no repentance, which he may have seen did not go down well the first time. If they get his point, they're still not taking it. That is, what I'm trying to do here is imagine these tales as told by an oral teller to a live audience. And anyone who's been involved as teller or audience with tale-telling orally knows that there's always interaction. It is not just, I mean, there's far more interaction usually than there is right now between us. You know, I'm not really watching your eyes that much to see how you react. I probably should be, but I'm not. I'm trying to watch my text and make a few little cuts as I go. So I'm trying to sense what might be the story of the telling of these stories here. And that's my guess about it, but it's only a guess, and it depends on overreading the breaks between the three parables as deliberate as silences and strategically used by Luke. Anyway, as I say, if they get his point, they're not taking it. They're holding back. The trouble getting through to these hard Pharisaic hearts may not have so much to do with subject or setting or protagonist, first rural, then domestic but feminine, as with narrative moves. Direct address and flat-out interpretation aren't visibly working, or so I take Luke's silences to say. We are free not to take the silences that way, free not to suppose silences at all, free to take the series of three tales as a single continuous discourse with the audience sitting as stolidly quiet and the teacher doggedly plodding on as in the worst gospel doctrine class you've ever attended. We are free to respond and interpret as we will, And that, I hope to imply, will be a large part of the point. I choose to hear brief narrative silences on Luke's part, and perhaps brief pauses on Jesus' part after each of those tales, each of the first two. And I rather aggressively read those silences as signifying that the tales, the first two, failed. You may doubt me. And to be sure, there's no question, these tales do each unmistakably illustrate the teller's explicit theme that there is festal joy in heaven when a sinner repents. So why murmur if Jesus eats with sinners? But ask yourself, did you care about either the shepherd or the housewife? Did you feel with either one's loss or either one's joy in finding what was lost? Are you ready, after these tales, to set aside your Pharisaic purity and receive sinners and eat with them? If so, welcome. If not, the teller has one more tale to try you with. The trouble with the first two tales lies in just the kind of success each so obviously and efficiently goes for. The clear illustration of an explicit and stated theme. Both tales are formally didactic. They are concrete illustrations or exempla or figures of the statable propositional truth that concludes them. In formally didactic tales, the teller's stance is always implicitly or explicitly, I say unto you. The teller has wisdom, has truth, and hands it down ex cathedra to the hearers. It's invariably a superior-inferior relation, structurally, with built-in structural resistance to change and perhaps built-in resentment. I'm thinking of myself when I read my students' stories. If the stories are too didactic, I resist. Someone is trying to stand, I mean, it's too much like this situation we're in right here, you know. Instead of a bunch of us hunkered down in the dust around the campfire, and when I'm saying, listen, I got this story, you got to hear this story, and we just listen. Now, that kind of story can still be very powerfully moral, but the whole structure of telling and receiving is different, and that's what I'm trying to talk about. It's no surprise if tales told this way, in this I say unto you manner, to exemplify flat-out truths, leave us flat, right where we started structurally, inferior down here. The most obvious difference of the third tale from the first two is length. And you can see it on the printed page. My overhead projector transparency would have done it quite beautifully, because it takes one column for the first two tales plus the introductory verses and two columns for the third tale. It's just physically unavoidable when you look at it. Twice as much as the third tale takes twice as much space as the other two combined. 22 verses against 8, not counting the two introductory verses. That immensely greater length is largely a function of narrative technique. And I feel a little apologetic for talking technically, but after all, that's what I've been doing much of my life. And that narrative technique, in turn, is the sign and method of an entirely different mode of moral teaching. All three stories are, in one sense, moral. They seek the moral improvement of their hearers. Jesus would like to persuade those Pharisees to treat sinners a little better, or at least not to be so grudging about him sitting down and eating with them. But the three stories differ in the ways that they are moral. The first two are tales told with morals, told to illustrate the teller's propositional truth. The third, and here I've got to strain the language a little for a distinction, is told morally. And I'll have to try to explain what I mean by that. I think I can do so in terms of the third tale's substance, and especially its greatly more generous narrative technique, its more generous telling. In that tale, Jesus becomes more fully a teller who resembles the protagonists he holds up as figures of a divine seeker and finder of the lost in the first two tales. That's a little tangled, isn't it? What I mean is that the shepherd coming back with the lost sheep, the woman having found the coin, each of them immediately and dramatically, as Jesus sets these stories up, says, turns to his or her friends and neighbors and says, "Rejoice with me. I found what I lost." It's that open and welcoming, let's have a party. And what I'm saying is that Jesus says, teller of the third tale, instead of saying, "I say unto you," is adopting a different stance. It's more the stance of, here's a story. A certain man had two sons. And now the rest I hope will become clear as I go along. What I'm saying is, as teller, he suddenly becomes more generous. He's a generous host, where before he was lecturing to them. And it's a different manner entirely. I got to work that one out, I can see. Two signs of that greater generosity of the teller are the absences that I've already noted. There's no direct second person address to the hearers and no authorial interpretation to close and close down the tale. Here the teller leaves us free to take up the tale or not. It's not saying, who among you, you know. And he leaves us free to make our own meanings in it. He's not going to explain it. Jean-Paul Sartre must feel odd to be brought into Jesus' company at this point, but in the terms of his wonderful essay, Why Write, this third tale declines to coerce or manipulate us and offers itself rather as a gift or pact of generosity between teller and hearer. Jesus as teller is again the welcoming host of sinners that Pharisees resent him for being. And here, rather than lecturing them in the mode of "I say unto you," he will welcome them into his tale to find whatever place they can. He and Luke offer us the same invitation. Maybe I say it better there after all. The largest narrative signs of the teller's generosity, which result in this tale's greater length, are the tale's much longer, more complex, and more complexly presented action, and its distribution of its narrative focus, or point of view, to use the English major's term, over three principal characters, the man and his two sons, one lost and repentant and found, the other, so the teller seems to allow, just and needing no repentance. With the hortatory or didactic "I say unto you" left behind, unless we still wish to invoke it contextually, the third tale more generously invites us to feel with and be moved by its three principal agents. The greater and different success of this method, I think, is sufficiently attested by the needful recourse and loving memory of two millennia of hearers, including St. Augustine in his Confessions, and I trust many of us. I'll parenthetically say here that after years of reading St. Augustine's Confessions in one or another translation, I suddenly realized that over and over there are echoes of this parable in it, and often at very crucial points in Augustine's spiritual career. And it suddenly struck me. This parable taught Augustine how to interpret his life. And I think it's done that for millions of Christians. I think, in fact, that it's a safe guess that the prodigal son is Jesus' favorite parable among Christians of every variety. It's certainly my own favorite. Our referring to it as the prodigal son says a lot about our moral relation to it. We identify most strongly with the lost and repentant, found and forgiven. We either are that or we sure as heck wish we were. Though it also, our identifying it that way may narrow our possible moral response to the story a little too sharply. Perhaps we identify most strongly with the errant and returning son in technical terms because the tale gives us a more intimate sense of his inner life, his spiritual trajectory. And that has to do with his more generous treatment of the story. We get inside that character. We're allowed to overhear him talking to himself, and that makes a big difference. The first difference, though, that we can notice in this tale, after the absence of a question aimed at us, is that rather than focusing on the loser and finder, it invites us to identify with the lost, and not a sheep or a coin, but a younger son. We're bidden here to look at lost and found from the other side. The finder's side seems to have failed to persuade us, so the teller tries the lost. It's also a very large difference that the lost here is no item of wealth, neither an animate sheep nor an inanimate coin, symbolic token of exchange, but a person, an agent like ourselves, a soul of infinite worth, lost by his own agency, and lost from the familial, the paternal, filial, and fraternal web of personal relations. It's an enormous difference, conceptually, in tale-telling. It's like going from a tiny short story to a novel, although on a much smaller scale, of course, than we usually experience those. It's one thing to tell of a single self seeking its lost property, finding it, and calling friends and neighbors to celebrate. And it's quite another thing to tell of a father and sons, brothers, each with his own agenda, which every agent has, and let each speak in his own voice. The teller enters the dangerous terrain of life as we know it, the real world that is the world of persons, each with his or her own voice and choice, where the agents risk everything, and perhaps the teller does too. Now, my best move here might be just to tell the tale and then shut up, which is what Jesus and Luke are confident enough to honor our free intelligence by doing. But I'll go on in my own dangerous analytic mode, and I'll be as brief and clear as I can, and I hope not to kill the story for it. I mean, hoping that I let it come alive. It's beautifully proportioned. The tale breaks near its halfway point, verse 20, where its first phase, the younger son's departure, desolation, and return, modulates into a second phase, the father's welcome. And that modulation, by the way, is carried in a deftly chiastic pattern which balances, "And he arose and came to his father," with, "His father saw him and had compassion and ran." So you get the son going toward the father, father going toward the son. It's a beautiful meeting, and it's beautifully constructed grammatically, at least in the English. I don't know how it works in Greek or whatever. And, of course, Jesus spoke it in Aramaic. Who knows? The tale's last half itself divides again just short of its midpoint with a surprising and much more abrupt shift from the merriment of the welcome home party, the music and dancing, to the elder son and his resentment on hearing the music and learning what it means, verses 25 and 28. This last phase culminates in an open-ended dialogue between the father and the elder son. Open-ended in that the teller does not tell its outcome, no more than Luke tells us the effect of the tale upon its hearing. That's very modern, by the way. That business of open endings is often thought of as characteristically modern. If so, well, someone was on to it a long, long time ago. In the first phase, we may come to know what it is not to lose, but to be lost, as we follow in the tale's sentences the younger son's journey into a far country, where he wastes his substance with riotous living, then begins to be in want, and joins himself to a citizen of that country, and gets sent into his fields to feed swine. The worst loss is not to have spent all the cash you turned your one-third portion of goods into, but to find that you would fain have filled your belly with the husks that the swine did eat. You've sunk as low as you can to a starving swineherd, hireling swineherd, whom no man gave unto. So it's a major turn in the tale's plot, as Augustine recognized. And there's a crucial moment in the Confessions where he echoes, "He came to himself." It's a major turn in the tale's plot when he came to himself and said, "How many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger?" It's my understanding that hired servant would be the lowest possible status in the ancient world. A household servant is part of the household, a member of the familia, or in Greek, the oikos. But a hired slave has no such settled status. At least I think that that's correct. In the In the Odyssey, there's a footnote on this. In fact, this is where I've picked up this notion. When Odysseus visits Hades and converses with heroes and others down there, one hero he converses with is Achilles. And if you remember your Iliad, Achilles is that Greek warrior hero who is said to have chosen a short life with glory as a warrior over a long life without it. But down in Hades, when Odysseus speaks to him, what Achilles says is, "Old friend, I would rather be a hired slave up there than the king down here." That's Homer's, or whoever wrote the Odyssey. That's probably the most telling single comment on war and warrior glory in all of ancient literature. He uses a single monosyllable word, which means a day laborer, one who's hired to do a job and then sent on his way. I would rather be that up in the world of light than down here. Well, again, that's a little digression and a footnote. But so my understanding is that a hired servant would be as low as you could get and have any status at all. You're barely there. So I think what's happening here is that the teller is taking himself and us about as far into the lost as we can go, imagining the private or inner voice of this self-desolated younger son. Without once addressing us in the second person, the tale is asking us, can you imagine lost? You ever been lost? This first phase culminates in the son's rehearsal of the speech he will make to his father. "I will arise and go to my father, and will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants." What a difference in "say unto" here. The intention of this protagonist, what he means to say and do, his expectation and hope. It arouses our own hope and expectation. Will he get to say that? Will his father say, "Okay, I'll hire you"? Sure. We know the story too well to enter it innocently. But if you think about it, that's where we are in storytelling terms. As the teller goes on, he seems to confirm the success of the protagonist's intent. "I will arise and go to my father" becomes, "and he arose and came to his father." The change in verb from "go to come to" is rather interesting, isn't it? But the world, life as we might know it, is not so simple. And action isn't at the determination of any single protagonist. There are other agents, other agendas. So the teller turns his tale on the word "but" and subordinates the tale's first agent to the first one it had named, that certain man. That is, now the son is in a subordinate clause and we shift to the father in the main clause. "But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him." I mean, the son is now the object of those verbs. Saw, kissed, fell on his neck. Like the searching shepherd and housewife of the first two tales, here his father, seeking the lost and rejoicing to find, is the subject of a series of urgently active verbs. We're on somewhat familiar ground here, but we're invited to draw nearer, to become intimately part of the moment of finding, as I think we're not in the first two tales. And there's no concern on the finder's part here for patriarchal dignity, only the rush of a heart breaking with compassion and joy. Can we feel it now? This would bring us about as far as the first two tales had. Why does Jesus receive sinners? Why shall there be joy in heaven? But now the tale, having opened two points of view, followed two principal agents, breaks fully into the dramatic mode, an exchange of gestures and speeches. The son, receiving his father's embrace and kiss, begins the speech he has carefully prepared. "Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son." Interesting tension in that sentence. It begins with the word "father" and ends by denying worthiness to be son. And that speaker's complicated feeling is all in that. Well, that's the last we're going to hear, that voice. The last that son will be mentioned by the teller of the tale. Though the father, a servant, and the elder son will all speak of him later. And I think he's implicitly there almost always. But half his prepared speech is all he gets out before the father said to his servants, "Bring forth the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the..." And you've got to think, well, he's got here barefoot. That dawns on you. Or he's worn out whatever sandals he had or shoes he had. Shoes on his feet. "And bring hither the fatted calf, and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." Now this is the way that you welcome properly any stranger, any guest who turns up. Food, clothing, a bath, all of that. Anyone who's read much ancient literature has seen that over and over again. With this long speech, and I think the teller is really spreading himself in these speeches. He's really delivering now. He was a little stingy compared to this on those first two stories. With this long speech, we're still about where we were with the final speeches of the first two tales. The glad voice of the finder calling us to eat and be merry. But with a huge difference. This is the world not of lost and found property, but of filial relation restored. It's a wider, deeper, more harrowing and joyous world. "For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." Those lines are very moving to me. It's hard for me to read the parable aloud. Even so, all narrative and emotional differences allowed, we are thematically, in terms of message, about where we were at the tale's opening. Except that the differences do make an enormous difference, such that our feeling with these agents has to have richly qualified, if not utterly swamped, our sense of the truth the teller already illustrated much more flatly. We're not looking at illustrations here. We're in the thick of an imagined experience, told and lived in the telling and hearing. And the teller does not stop, not even there. And that's the other surprising thing about this story. I mean, if that were the point, he's made it three times now. If the point were the point. If the statable point were the point. But of course it's not. He doesn't stop. "While they began to be merry," verse 24, he makes his most surprising shift, and it's as deft as any modernist writer's, to focus on the elder son out working in the field. "And as he came and drew nigh to the house, he heard music and dancing." The sound of that merriment, which we hear as and when he does, though we already know what it means, and he does not. If the tale's agents so far, father and son, can be equated to finder and lost, to Jesus and the sinners he receives, who is this third agent? Who but the Pharisees, whose murmur called forth this series of tales? What but the other relevant point of view already given in the occasion, in those opening verses? The teller gives the Pharisees' self-righteousness full play in this story, as the elder son calls a servant and learns what the music means. "Thy brother is come, and thy father hath killed the fatted calf, because he hath received him safe and sound." An honest report, if just the brute facts, with a little bit of interpretation of the father's motive on the part of that servant. The emphasis on killing the fatted calf, it's probably the servants who had to do this, you realize, even though it's ascribed to the father. Well, anyway, it's an honest and brief report. "And he was angry and would not go in." That's about where we came in on Luke's view of those surly Pharisees standing back from this man receiving sinners and eating with them. "But therefore came his father out and entreated him." There, this tale has folded itself back over the entire episode, if you will. Jesus entreating the Pharisees to at least understand why he receives and eats with sinners. I suspect that I'm making all this look much more narratively self-conscious on Jesus' and Luke's parts than most of you could believe might have been the actual case. But it's hard for me not to see these kinds of thick interconnections between this complicated tale and the urgent occasion that it answers to. Here the teller risks the entire tale's desired effect of winning the hearts of the Pharisees by risking the alienation of his hearers when he lets their truculent voice take over, that truculent his and his brother's stories. And he answering said to his father, "Lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither transgressed I at any time thy commandment, and yet thou never gavest me a kid, that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this thy son was come, which hath devoured thy living with harlots, thou hast killed for him the fatted calf." He seized on that fatted calf. That's going to be his big symbol of... And notice it's an item of property, consumable item of property, and so forth. Well, resentment, accusation, self-praise, those are not a very winning combination. The elder son almost... He implicitly disclaims his fraternal relation with this thy son and exaggerates facts he may know nothing about in hath devoured thy living with harlots. He knows, as we do, that the father divided unto them his living, in verse 12. That is, he turned the property over to both sons, a double portion to the elder under Jewish law. Of the younger son's portion, all we know is the teller's somewhat milder wasted his substance with riotous living. No mention of harlots in the voice of the teller. Having practically declared himself out of the family, we might expect the elder son will get a stinging rebuke. So here's the teller's last surprise. Maybe we should have seen it coming. It's consistent with his message at the end of the first two tales and with the generous father's character as we've already seen it dramatized in welcoming home the lost son. But its very mildness might stun us. Its lack of resentment at resentment. Its welcome of this complainer. Its lack of the faintest hint of rebuke even as it corrects one misstatement, "Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine." It's literal fact, since the father divided unto them his living at the start of the story, and the younger son's portion has been wasted. The father barely responds to the elder son's denial of brotherhood, simply transforms his resentful, "This thy son," to "This thy brother," reaffirming their fraternal bond as he reaffirms his paternal bond to both of them. And he ignores the accusation completely. "It was meet that we make merry and be glad. For this thy brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found." Does the demonstrative "this" used by both the elder son and the father indicate that the lost and found son has also come out to be a silent actor in this scene? It's a little painful to think so. Yet harder, perhaps, not to think so. Trained as they are on a myriad clincher scenes at the ends of movies and TV sitcoms, our imaginations may want to see the screen darken and the strings crescendo on a final family hug. Jesus doesn't give us that. On the father's last syllable, he stops, leaves it all wide open, as Luke in his turn does the same. We are left to choose to write our own scripts. And many of us have, some of us professionally. Who are you? Some of us have filmed them. Even. Who are you? The tale has asked us. Lost? Found? Finder? Always home and never transgressing? Welcome then. It is meet that we should make merry and be glad. That, I will say, is moral storytelling. Generous to all the points of view that have any claim on the teller's attention, giving all their due, declining to coerce hearers or to assert the finality of an authorial interpretation. Not even in the voice of a teller most Christians would regard as most of all having authority. My friend John Bunyan says that this one tale is his model for fiction writing. He could hardly do better, and he's not alone and not the first to take this as his model. Heaven may be a kingdom, with all of hierarchy and structure that that implies, yet with so many other figures that Jesus uses elsewhere in the Gospels, these three tales say that, among all the other things they say, that the kingdom of heaven is a feast, is a welcome home party, is a symposium, is a banquet, is music and dancing, and we are all welcome. May we heed the bidding of the teller, whose telling is generous enough for all our tales. Thank you. That was longer than I expected, but Rob asked if I would be willing to take questions, and I guess so. I don't know. It's not normal to ask questions after a sermon.
That's very didactic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, what she's asking how I'm not sure if I can quite rephrase your question. How conscientious can it be and still be effective? I guess it's a question of conscientious to what. And when I look at one of the things that I have wanted to do for many years as a teacher of reading and writing is to rehabilitate the didactic. I mean, when I grew up through an English major at BYU, didactic was a bad word, and I apologize if I've made it sound like a bad word here. The thing that I want to say is that how would I put it? Certain ways of using the didactic seem to me implicitly ungenerous and less effective than other ways of telling stories. So that the stance of the didactic, the very consciously didactic writer who'll tell you the story and either flat out state the truth at the end of it, or have a character do it for him or her, or build the story so carefully that you can't mistake it. And there I'm edging on to the other kind of story that's in this chapter in a way, and it gets hard to distinguish. That, what I think I'm saying is that kind of storytelling somehow certainly is conscientious. It's very concerned that the hearer shall know what the point is and not make it, but not have any mistake about it. And everything in the tale is kind of stripped down and constructed to make that point. And I guess my point is that there are other ways of being conscientious. There are other ways of being true to one's moral code, to one's deepest beliefs. And didactic fiction is only one form of fiction. It's one of the major forms of fiction, but the other way of telling a story without insisting you've got to understand it this way and only this way. And I don't think most hearers of The Prodigal Son are going to go wrong on their understanding of what it means. I think, for instance, though, in some discussions I've read within the LDS context, there's an awful lot of emphasis on how much better you'd be if you were the good guy who stayed home, and how you really have lost it all, you know. And I think that that's kind of distorting the tone, if not the point of the story. On the other hand, when we say, well, that nasty elder brother, look at that guy, he's as bad a sinner as his, you know, Jesus doesn't say that. He doesn't let the tale say that. Son, thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. That is, Jesus allows the Pharisees, and this is part of the teller's generosity, he allows the Pharisees their own estimation of themselves. He's not going to challenge it. They may at some point, you know, and I consider that moral and literary generosity, you know, in a very high degree. Maybe I'm overstating it a little bit. By presenting the elder son as the truculent whiner that he does, surely he makes a point about that attitude. But, and as I was saying, he could have blown it right there. I mean, the teller really does risk it there. If he's trying to win these Pharisees, then to present, give us a character who pretty clearly represents them and make him such a bad guy is a risk losing it all. And maybe, and who knows? Luke is silent. We have no idea what the Pharisees did. But to me, that's very conscientious too, to shut up and leave it to the freedom of the hearer or the reader, because those questions are just resonating all over the place. Who are you? You know, are you lost? Are you found? Are you a finder? Are you a good guy who was always home and never did any bad stuff? And our answer is, I've been all of those. I've been every one of them. And who knows who I'll be? You know, and to me, that's very conscientious and generous. There's a conscientiousness that in the formally didactic tale seems to me to be almost coercive. It's trying to say you must understand exactly what I mean. You know, and I'm goodness. I mean, 5 days a week I'm didactic. I have to be. But 5 mornings a week, if I'm sitting and writing fiction, and I wish I were 5 mornings of every week, I'm trying to do the other thing. I'm trying to learn from. You know, I don't want to be a Pharisee, but if I'm going to write a story, I have to be that surly younger elder brother. If I'm going to really tell that story, I got to let that voice there in all its surliness. It's got to be there. And so, to me, that's a larger kind of conscientiousness as a storyteller. I wish I really were a storyteller. I mean, I have to labor in silence, writing sentence after sentence to do a story. You ask someone like me a question, he talks forever. Yeah, go ahead. I would certainly say so. That for me to find the meaning myself, rather than having it rammed down my throat, or let's be gentler, we can say, rather than having it stated flat out. Because it is my discovery, it is mine, and yet it is not mine. It is the teller's, and it is his or hers who hears it as I do. But it matters. It matters more to me. I think that, you know, the thing about the formally didactic tale, which explicitly states its point, is that having the point stated and knowing what it is, I'm not particularly disposed to look at the tale anymore. Why bother? I don't need it. There's joy in heaven when a sinner repents. That's what I need to, you know, and you could say that's very efficient. That's what I need to know. But when it isn't stated, then I have to look at the tale. I have to keep living in it and finding it out. And my own... for instance, I'm happier to have found what I found about Luke 15 as I did than to have had, say, Joachim Jeremias or some other scholar tell me all about it. In fact, I own his book, Rediscovering the Parables of Jesus, and I've deliberately avoided reading it, and I deliberately avoided trying to see the recent LDS film because I wanted to work through and put down what I felt I'd discovered over a period of about 10 years. But it was really amazing. I was struggling in a class, a team taught class, a couple of my colleagues, and I was on the hot spot that day. And we were all trying to get them to understand something about reading stories. And I suddenly said, look, think about this. Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, and all of a sudden I was telling Luke 15. I was making mistakes and not remembering the text right and everything, but I suddenly was standing up there telling that story, and as I was doing it, I was figuring it out. I was, for the first time in my life, saying, oh my gosh, this never hit me before. I never realized this. And it meant far more. I mean, even my rather technical, you know, English major writer-teacher discoveries about it were making it mean more to me. I hope that can be true for at least some other people. So, yeah, my feeling is that it's much more, it's morally, ethically, far more powerful. It is risky, it's dangerous to just tell a story and turn it over to the characters, you know. The teller really backs out of that one. No, I say unto you. He just tells it. And not only does he tell it, but it's very important that those voices are in there. A little context for this. Someone stop me before I ramble again. Some of you may know that in the Republic of Plato, there is a very important discussion of tale-telling. And Socrates takes the position that we'd better not have imitative poetry in our ideal city that we're trying to construct here, because imitative poetry means that the poet and the audience both are going to imitate bad guys. And if they're not imitating bad guys, they're imitating mixed guys, people who got some good and some bad in them. And that's not going to be good for the guardians of our city. It's a chunk of the Republic concerned about the education of the guardians, who have to be brave, absolutely loyal warriors, able to defend the city from all possible attacks. And so Socrates is arguing that imitative poetry, because the poet takes on the voice of this or that character, will inevitably be corrupting to the soul of the poet and of the audience, because those characters, to be interesting, are going to be mixed or bad. And that's one of the most powerful arguments ever made in Western culture about poetry or about fiction, about how it's good and or about how it's bad for you. One of the things that I'm saying and have been saying for about 6 years now is that's not what Jesus thinks. It's clear from his practice that he, as a tale-teller, that he could not agree with Socrates. That he, here and in other parables, and it's clear from the writer that the writers of the Gospels often present the voices of. They're not just telling it in their voice, but they're giving it to the characters. They imitate bad people. So it just seems utterly clear to me that literally speaking, I've got, if I mean to be Christian, I'd better side with Jesus and not with Socrates. Though I find Socrates' arguments very powerful. And I do think that fiction is dangerous, because you might just find yourself wanting to be more Pharisaic than Jesus would have you be. If I think about my experiences in the wards I've lived in, some people do find that an attractive alternative. And a lot of us find wasting our substance in riotous living a very attractive alternative. So it's a risky thing. But it does seem to me that Jesus as a tale-teller, and Luke and Mark and Matthew and John, are committed to that. They'll tell you what Judas says. They'll let his voice be heard. You don't get to hear him very much, but biblical storytellers imitate the bad and the good and the mixed, and that's where I think Western literature comes from. And a great deal that makes us nervous about, especially modern literature, really has its roots in this kind of storytelling. And so sometimes it's morally bad for us, I guess. Okay, yeah, Rob's telling me time's up. Thanks very much. I hope it was worth your time to be here. And if it wasn't, well, you can always go read the scriptures again. So, that's what I do. Thanks.